You are listening to a sermon by Derek Carr, recorded on Sunday, August 9th, 2015, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Thank you, Evan, and thank you for having me back again. I'm coming to wonder a bit whether you're really gluttons for punishment. But anyway, the other thing I'd like to say before I start is that this looks as though it'll be good for about 3 hours, but I print it in very big type, so I can actually see it, and as usual I've left my reading glasses at home, so luckily I printed it in the big format, so you're only going to get about maybe 7 minutes, you know, serious reflection, in spite of the fact it looks like about the size of a novel. I'm going to talk, it's a sort of almost X-rated title, The Plight of the Pregnant Prioress and the Power of Prayer, Reflections on a Medieval Spanish Miracle Tale. So if you think it's getting a little bit beyond the limit, then you know, you can just close your ears. Now, as I'm sure you all know, statues and icons of the Virgin Mary in her various manifestations, Our Lady of Lourdes, Our Lady of Fatima, and so on, they figure prominently in Catholic churches nowadays. Whether they should or not is a different matter. You can talk about that later. But this is, you know, the way things are these days. But popular devotion to the Virgin Mary was not a prominent feature in the Western Church through the late Roman period and into the early Middle Ages. Now, certain saints, individual saints, such as Saint Augustine of Hippo, 4th, 5th century, and people like Ildefonso or Ildefonsus of Toledo in Spain, who lived during the Visigothic period, the early 7th century, just to give a couple of them, to name a couple, they did in fact cultivate a very strong personal veneration of the Blessed Virgin Mary. But on the whole, it was not something that had trickled down to the grassroots level. But things started to change when we reached the High Middle Ages towards the end of the 11th century. Marian devotion, devotion to the Virgin Mary, grows rapidly, and it gives rise to an immense output of literature in the form of treatises, hymns, poetry, and song. Much of it in Latin, of course, for the consumption of the clergy, but also a quite significant amount directed to a more general public in the vernacular languages of Europe. And there's been a fair amount of speculation and historical research into why this should happen. Why did it take so long, depending on how you look at it? Why did it happen at all? And there seems to be various things going on. It tends to coincide with the rise of the Manichaean movement again, the Cathars in southern France, the Bogomils in the Eastern Church, who, among other things, cultivated the feminine element as part of their ethos. And it may well have filtered upwards from popular tradition, the Celtic traditions of Western Europe, in which there were a great deal of veneration for earth goddesses of one sort or another, and goddesses who looked after the harvest and all this sort of thing. It seems to have been a sort of popular, what the official word is, syncretism, where you mix official doctrine with popular tradition. And if you look at the history of the church carefully, you'll see there's an awful lot of this. Christianity has brought into itself a lot of tradition, not just from the Jewish background, but from the mystery religions of ancient Greece, and from popular traditions as well. And many of the official feast days of the Catholic Church are in fact simply official recognition of harvest festivals of one sort or another, things that happened at specific times of the year because of the change of seasons. Now, one of the fruits of this expansion of what we call Marian literature is a work which is called in Spanish Los Milagros de Nuestra Señora, The Miracles of Our Lady. It's a book which was written by a man called Gonzalo de Berceo, who was a well-educated Spanish priest who lived in the region of La Rioja, where the good red wine comes from in northern Spain, during the first half of the 13th century. Initially, it was thought that Berceo was a member of a monastery in that area, but subsequent research shows that he was, in fact, probably a canon and possibly even also a civil lawyer, a priest, who acted as a sort of agent, if you like, between the monastery, the enclosed community, and the outside world, with civil authority and so on. Now, in the introduction of this book, The Miracles, Los Milagros, Berceo tells us that while he was going on a pilgrimage, possibly the way of St. James, the Camino de Santiago, we don't know, he tells us that he took refuge from the blazing heat of the noonday sun in a shady garden, which he then proceeds to describe in great detail. And I must say that it sounds like a wonderful spot to be in. It had lush green grass on which to lie, in the shade of trees laden with ripe fruit fresh for the traveller's picking, and a cool, gentle breeze wafting the scent of wild flowers through the air, which was filled with birdsong. The Garden of Eden, basically. Four streams run from each corner of the garden to refresh the traveller. They are warm in the winter and cool in the summertime. And the author, Berceo, then goes on to interpret all the elements of this garden in an allegorical fashion, and this is typical of medieval literature. Nothing is as it seems in a literal way. Everything has to have a hidden or allegorical meaning. And he likens this garden to paradise itself. He says that if Adam and Eve had eaten of this fruit that he encounters, there would have been no fall and no original sin. And then he goes on to tell us that the trees represent all the miracles that have been attributed to the Virgin Mary. Now, it's a very poetical introduction and very reverent, and it gives the impression that we're going to be treated to a very pious and devotional account in verse of a series of miracles attributed to the Virgin Mary. But what follows is a collection of stories which is picked from various sources, and like Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, they contain a great deal of ribald humour that modern readers may find hard to relate to the doctrinal and the devotional content. One of them, miracle number 21 in the collection, is called La Abadesa Encinta, the Pregnant Abbess. And the story is a bit complicated, but in essence it goes as follows. The unnamed abbess or prioress of an unspecified convent, well liked by all and sundry for her kindness and generosity and for the charitable way in which she governed her community, she falls victim one day to a great temptation and becomes pregnant. Oh dear. Now, the man involved in this mystery is not named in this poem. In another version, in a collection of songs of Holy Mary put together by King Alphonse X of Castile, again 13th century, the man is identified as a man from Bologna. So it just goes to show you can't trust these Italians. My wife is never very happy with that remark, since she is Italian. So. Now, as the outward signs of her pregnancy develop, and the poet obviously referred to a medical textbook for this part of his story, he describes the increase in weight, the change in shape and complexion and all this sort of thing. As this all becomes more and more evident, discord arises in the convent, as you can imagine, and the abbesses or the prioresses' detractors in the community inform the local bishop of their suspicions, And he comes to the convent to deal with the case. And while he is resting from his journey, the abbess, who has always had a great devotion to the Blessed Virgin Mary, prays fervently to Our Lady to liberate her from her distress. And Our Lady, taking pity on her, appears to her in the company of two angels. And together they assist in an absolutely painless childbirth. And the angels carry off the child to be cared for by a hermit in the forest. The abbess gives copious thanks to Our Lady, but is then called into the presence of the bishop to explain herself. And he's ready to remove her from her duties, but he insists on a full investigation by trustworthy priests who conduct a complete physical examination of the abbess. And when they find absolutely no evidence whatsoever, neither of pregnancy nor of childbirth, the bishop turns upon the detractors, threatening to expel them from the convent. And at this point, the abbess, who is very charitable, takes him aside and confesses the truth. The astounded bishop restores peace to the convent, and he makes provision for the care and the education of the infant, who in due time becomes a holy priest and is handed the reins of the diocese after the bishop dies. And the poem ends with the following words, and I translate. Let us all give thanks to the glorious Virgin, of whom we have read and experienced so many miracles. May she grant us her grace, so we may serve her, and may she lead us to do those things whereby we may be saved. Amen. Now, this story, of course, raises various issues, which I can only touch upon briefly this morning. A jaded modern reader might claim that this is nothing more than a titillating tale made officially acceptable by a pious conclusion. Yet, those who are familiar with medieval life and literature know that the sacred and the profane share the same space in medieval times. There's a constant jostling between the freedom of carnival and the restrictions of Lent. The physical and the spiritual coexist in an intimate way. They're often contrasted, but they're also intertwined in a very existential fashion by a people much more attuned to the harsh, concrete realities of daily life than most of us are in our comfortable modern environment. The Dutch historian Johan Huizinga put it so nicely at the beginning of his classic work, The Autumn of the Middle Ages, and I quote here from a fairly recent English translation. He starts his book saying, "When the world was half a thousand years younger, all events had much sharper outlines than now. The distance between sadness and joy, between good and bad fortune, seemed to be much greater than for us. Every experience had that degree of directness that joy and sadness still have in the mind of a child." In the same way, the episode of the abbess's succumbing to physical temptation is vividly contrasted with her eloquent and sincere plea for God's forgiveness and mercy through the intercession of the Blessed Virgin Mary. Now, what I think we have in this story is a pretty clear portrayal of the Church's, at least the Catholic Church's, official view of Our Lady's role as a mediatrix between mankind and God, presented in a way that will catch our attention much more vividly than abstract theological treatises. And what is it precisely about the abbess's condition that captures Our Lady's attention? Well, we're dealing here with a common process in medieval literature which is called typology. This is to say that the abbess is to be taken as a type of the Virgin Mary, in the sense that she shares some, though obviously not all, of her characteristics and circumstances. Like Mary, she is an unwed mother-to-be, having to deal with the suspicion and rejection of society, while at the same time maintaining her faith in the saving power of God, and ultimately seeing her son become a holy leader of God's people. So the story reminds us that, like it or not, we are all prone to sin of one kind or another, no matter how devout we strive to be. And none of us can claim the privilege of casting the first stone. Sin may cause a social strife or rejection in this world, but true repentance will greatly improve our lot in the next. And the story tells us Our Lady, time after time, is there to help. Now, whether or not we go along with the Catholic belief in the mediating power of the saints, I think the big challenge that many of us face, and I certainly do, is the progress from intellectual assent to an actual personal relationship, be it with Our Lady, or with Jesus, or directly with God the Father himself. I can recite the standard prayers with no intellectual qualms whatsoever. Yet believing, for me at least, is not at all the same thing as knowing, of having a direct personal contact with Our Lady or with God, of somehow feeling their presence in my bones. God for me is indeed a reality, but I have to admit that he still remains a distant reality, not unlike my relatives on the other side of the Atlantic, rather than a friendly next door neighbour with whom I can have a daily chat over the garden fence. So while I still try to figure out how to rectify this situation, and I would welcome any suggestions that you may have, I continue to remain most envious of Father Bertheo's pregnant abbess, who, in spite of her most visible human lapse, kept open a vital and very personal line of communication with God through her devotion to Our Mother of Perpetual Help, the Star of the Sea, and the guide of the wanderer here below. So thank you very much for your attention, and I'm willing to absorb questions and comments.